Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, we delve a little deeper into our series, Connecting the Commonwealth series on vaccines called Unraveling Immunity. In this collaboration with CAI, GBH, and New England Public Media in Springfield, we're going to take a statewide look at the issue. We begin with the editor for the series, who's also the editor for Connecting the Commonwealth, Jennifer Moore. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. First of all, I think there might be people go, what is Connecting the Commonwealth? We've mentioned it, but there's still some listeners who may not know what that is. So talk about Connecting the Commonwealth, the efforts and what it is.
Sure, happy to. So Connecting the Commonwealth is a fairly new partnership that brings together three public media newsrooms across Massachusetts. So CAI, as you mentioned, and then also GBH based in Boston and NEPM out in Springfield in Western Mass. The idea is we can do more together. And so this is our real first news series that we kind of kick the tires on this partnership and see what we can do across our platforms.
Yeah, and the whole idea is to get a statewide look at these issues that impact us statewide, right? So this series was your idea, and I know listeners always want to hear the background. How did you come up with this idea? Usually this happens after we see some sort of a big outbreak in our state, right? But you're like, we're going to do this before.
Right. I will say one of the critiques of journalism, and I think it's a fair one of the industry, is that we wait sometimes until there is a disaster, until there is an outbreak. But for me, looking at these numbers coming from a medical family, having done a medical fellowship in journalism, I was looking at the numbers of, first of all, the cases of measles and whooping cough in particular rising across the country, and then comparing that to the percentages of vaccination rates in Massachusetts, particularly in some pockets of Massachusetts where vaccination rates are fairly low. And so just putting those two together and saying, you know what? I think there is a story of risk here. There's a story of vulnerability to be told. Now, that doesn't always sell with editors and newsrooms. And so there were a few questions. And I will say it's more challenging of a story to tell, I think, than once an outbreak has happened. But I feel there's no greater public service than to raise a flag and say, let's take a closer look at this. This might be.
And interestingly, this week, as we kick off the series, 153 students from two schools in South Carolina are under quarantine for 21 days because of measles exposures. So far, none in Massachusetts, but we'll see. Right.
Yeah. You never know, especially since, one of the things we looked at in this series is that, we are a big tourism hotspot. We bring people from all over the world. So again, it's looking at prevention and looking at vulnerabilities.
So this year, the U.S. has seen 44 outbreaks of measles as of October 14th, 1,596 confirmed measles cases, a disease that was declared eliminated from the country back in 2000. Chris Burrell takes us to Martha's Vineyard, where a local campaign is underway to prevent an outbreak there.
Kids run and play on grassy fields during recess at this elementary school in Chilmark on Martha's Vineyard. The town is famous for exclusive beaches and multi-million dollar ocean views. What's less well known is this data point. Only 82% of kindergartners at this school over the past 3 years had the vaccine that prevents measles, according to the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. That's far below the rate of 95% that experts say is necessary for herd immunity. Janice Brown is a retired school nurse who worked for decades in Chilmark and two other island schools.
People see, do live in a false sense of protectiveness here because we are geographically isolated.
The state tracks how many students are vaccinated and against which diseases. And here in Dukes County, where the vineyard is located, the total exemptions stand at 4.2% of students. That's nearly three times the state average. Those numbers keep Leah Hamner up at night. She's an epidemiologist for Dukes County and for Barnstable County on Cape Cod. And she's keeping a close eye on the possibility of measles in particular, because it's highly contagious.
If measles gets into these tight-knit, under-vaccinated communities, it's explosive. It might be by after-school program. It might be at potlucks. Frankly, based on how vaccination rates are going, I expect to face a measles outbreak.
Besides its vaccine rates, Martha's Vineyard is also vulnerable because it's a big tourist destination. Ferries like this one, pulling away from Woods Hole and bound for Oak Bluffs, bring hundreds of thousands of people a year to the island. Again, here's local epidemiologist Leah Hamner.
There are people who get infected in airports and bus stations. And the thing about measles is that it can linger in the air for 2 hours after that infected person leaves. We have no measles cases in Massachusetts residents this year to date. And so it's going to show up. It's going to be imported.
Here on the vineyard, there's only one full-time pediatrician, Sonia Stevens. She says vaccine skepticism has been on the rise over the last decade. And one cause for it here is a culture that stresses natural foods and limited vaccines.
They feel like they live a healthy lifestyle in nature and eat organic food and, you know, as chemical-free as feasible. It may be a healthier lifestyle. It doesn't necessarily give you any protection against infectious diseases. But I do think it gives people this halo of feeling less vulnerable.
We reached out to several parents with vaccine skepticism, but none agreed to an interview. The island also has a sizable Brazilian population. And Stevens says her Brazilian patients, in general, believe strongly in vaccinating their children. But she says immigration raids on the island are already impacting her patients' medical routines.
We had, you know, many canceled or no-showed appointments. I think the current climate on the vineyard and in general make them fearful of coming to appointments, and that can create another barrier to them completing their series.
Meanwhile, leaders here are planning what to do if there is an outbreak of measles, whooping cough, or another infectious disease. Betsy Van Landingham is an island nurse helping with that effort.
What exactly is going to happen the minute I hear that someone has been confirmed as having measles? Who am I going to call first? Who am I going to call second?
Island officials have launched a social media campaign to counter misinformation. A major outbreak of a disease like measles is a scenario they hope they never have to face. But they're doing their best to be ready, just in case. For Connecting the Commonwealth, I'm Chris Burrell.
Jennifer, you know, you can see how you might have this false sense of security as Chris is talking about how rural the vineyard is. And you do, it's easy to kind of forget how contagious measles, and I didn't realize it hangs in the air for 2 hours. So you could just be walking through. I mean, it's just the potential here is really high.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure some of your guests later on the show would be able to talk much more about that as an infectious disease. But I will say, in terms of, you know, measles, whooping cough, these kind of almost, you know, in some people's minds, an old-timey diseases that are making a comeback. As we mentioned, the United States had declared it eliminated in the year 2000, and yet here we are. Mm. But yes, measles is highly contagious, and the can be very severe. So it's definitely something they're watching out for.
And another area public health officials are keeping an eye on is the western part of the state, which also has vaccination rates lower than the 95% needed for herd immunity. New England Public Media's Karen Brown reports there's not much schools can do in Massachusetts if parents don't get their children vaccinated.
If you see your ride, please walk to your ride!
Greenfield Middle School is letting out for the day. Kids are flowing into cars and chatting with friends. They look like a typical group of boisterous tweens. But there is something that puts this school on one end of a bell curve when it comes to health status. It's got one of the lowest vaccination rates in the state.
No, I had no idea.
That's PTO President Andrea Michael, who, like most parents in this Franklin County town and everywhere, does not check the state's immunization data on a regular basis.
I feel like it would be more on the radar if I heard about people having measles or if there was a lot of illness in the community.
That may be, but her school and others have what health experts call serious gaps in immunity. In fact, says regional epidemiologist Jack Sullivan,
and the gap, especially in some of the Greenfield schools, is just astronomical.
Health experts say a community reaches herd immunity when 95% of people are vaccinated. That means enough people are immune to an illness, like measles, polio, or whooping cough, that a few stray germs won't take hold. And while Massachusetts as a whole has one of the highest vaccination rates in the country,
you have to really drill down for each of the towns and the schools.
And Greenfield is not alone. A number of schools in every Western Mass county except Hampshire have vaccination rates well below herd immunity. Sullivan says there could be many explanations, like poor record keeping or high exemption rates, since Massachusetts allows parents to opt out of vaccines for medical or religious reasons. In addition, unhoused children and refugees are not subject to the same state requirements.
But even if you bake all of those possibilities into it, there's still going to be a very high number that are not vaccinated or don't have the records. And that's where it gets concerning.
But not everyone feels that way.
I think when you just look at the numbers and you don't put in all the outside factors, it can be worrisome. But I personally am not concerned about our vaccination rates.
Megan Tudrin is the public health nurse for Greenfield and surrounding towns. She says anyone who wants to get their child vaccinated has access to a free clinic or pharmacy.
And if they choose not to, then I believe it's their choice. You know, they may become sick at some point, but the rest of the population is going to be protected if they've had their vaccines.
And she acknowledges those children, even without official exemptions, will still be allowed in class. According to the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, even though vaccines are a state requirement, it's up to local school districts to enforce the mandate. And they can choose not to, at least until there's an outbreak of measles or another disease.
It's a conundrum. What are you going to do? Have them stay at home and not become educated?
Azelle Kavan is spokesperson for Springfield's school department, where about a dozen schools have vaccination rates under 90%.
So we try to find out what the barriers are. Sometimes it's their religious exemptions. Sometimes they're just uneducated. So we really try to take that route as opposed to keeping students out of school.
And when ideology or safety concerns are the issue, epidemiologist Jack Sullivan says providers should focus on explaining the science of vaccines.
I understand and I respect people's decisions when it comes to some of these, if they're based on the best information that they can get. And unfortunately, when politics starts to intrude in it, the best information is not always there.
For Connecting the Commonwealth, I'm Karen Brown.
We're going to talk more with healthcare professionals as we get more into the hour. But Jennifer, before we let you go, I'm wondering your thoughts on what you hope comes from this series, sort of the listener takeaway, if you will.
You know, I really hope that we have better understanding of the sentiments across the Commonwealth, right? We're going to hear more later in the hour on parents' personal decisions in terms of faith guiding them. And I think that beyond just understanding, that can help inform policy. I think that can also help us see where the vulnerabilities are specifically, and maybe even show us how to seek partners for getting a better grasp on this this situation. I also hope people, you know, understand the science and the data. But really, as you know, Mindy, it's human storytelling that that gets those numbers to land in a powerful way.
Right. Jennifer Moore is editor for Connecting the Commonwealth and editor for the series Unraveling Immunity. Thanks for being with us this morning, Jennifer. Appreciate your time.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, barriers to vaccination. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point. We're taking a closer look at a series we're airing this week called Unraveling Immunity. We heard about vaccination rates in schools on the Vineyard and in the western part of the state. In this segment, we look at barriers to getting vaccines, particularly to immigrant communities. CAI's Gil DeGeist spoke with Cheryl Bartlett, the CEO of New Bedford Community Health, which serves a diverse population. Here's their conversation.
What does it mean to be fully vaccinated?
I think it means different things for different vaccines. I think there is a misnomer that people are fully vaccinated means they won't get the disease. Really, what it is to try to get a majority of the population vaccinated and create what we call herd immunity, is that it's hard for these diseases to get into a population and create illness, and illness often creates the ability for these diseases to be communicable to other people. And so what they primarily do is limit the severity of an illness. We saw that with COVID, but it also does prevent morbidity and mortality.
How can people check on their own vaccination records?
Sometimes that's hard the older that you are and trying to track down your primary care provider. But with many of the diseases that vaccines prevent or reduce illness, we can take what's called a titer. We can do a blood sample and we can see if the body still has antibodies to a particular condition. So that's one way that people can track down their status if they're having trouble finding their own vaccine records. Some of it is depending on what age you are when vaccines really became widely available and when many school systems in many states have required certain vaccines. So schools have a lot of requirements around vaccination that of late are under threat. And I think that we'll begin to see childhood diseases that have been well managed over many, many decades thanks to vaccines.
In your experience, what are some of the most common barriers that make it harder for people to get vaccinated?
The most significant barrier to vaccines is the cost. If insurances don't cover it, then most people won't pay to get them. And their vaccines can be rather expensive. And we're fortunate that we live in the state of Massachusetts because there's policy and funding for all children to be vaccinated for free. So there shouldn't be a barrier for anybody getting vaccines in Massachusetts for childhood diseases, and actually most diseases. Thankfully, the governor just put in place state regulations around ensuring that that access has not been diminished by some of the changes that are coming out of the federal government. But that is not true across the country. And why that matters to us here in Massachusetts is that whole idea, again, of herd immunity, right? If people come from other states and other places and haven't been vaccinated, then they can bring disease into our state, into our community.
New Bedford is one of many places across Massachusetts that has a significant immigrant community. At CAI, we're hearing from healthcare providers on Martha's Vineyard that some immigrant families are maybe not making their vaccination appointments or not coming to the doctor out of fear of being swept up in this latest wave of immigration enforcement actions. So I wonder, is that something you are seeing in New Bedford or something you're concerned about for the population you serve?
Fortunately, we have seen in the adult population, there hasn't been a significant drop in people coming in for appointments, but we have seen that in the pediatric population. Some of it is related to family members that have been detained, and therefore there isn't a parent to bring the child in or a guardian that can allow for the care to be approved. So we have had to really reach out to our patients and try to ensure that they can come there and feel safe while they're inside our facility. What we can't provide for them is a guarantee of any protection outside of the health center. And I think the most disturbing new possibility is an order that came out in July from the federal government that says that community health centers are no longer a safe haven for people that are undocumented or in a questionable documented class of immigrant.
What are other unique challenges that present when serving an immigrant population?
Many of those immigrant populations come from countries where they actually didn't have access to vaccinations. So oftentimes they come here without any of the routine childhood vaccines that we have been providing here for many decades. And so kids coming into the school system, it's very critical that they get vaccinated because they're likely to have been exposed to those conditions and could possibly, again, bring them into a population that's been fairly well protected.
Is there anything else you want to add?
Community health centers have actually had a mandate to serve people regardless of their document status, regardless of their ability to pay. All of a sudden now we have these new directives that are suggesting that community health centers are no longer a place where people can come, regardless of their status or their ability to pay. So if this new directive were to be put into effect, then in essence, all the undocumented patients that we currently serve would have to be refused services. And now we're being told that if this rule goes into place, we will have to verify if someone is a citizen. And then there are different qualifications of who would be refused care. And I have to say, I've been a nurse for over 50 years, and the idea of turning people away is just sort of against my whole career. We've spent decades and decades as a country trying to figure out ways of more cost-effectively providing care for people, and that was the evolution of the community health center. And now we are starting to tear apart that foundation.
That's Cheryl Bartlett, registered nurse and president and CEO of New Bedford Community Health. Cheryl, thank you so much.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Also, the first nurse to have served as Commissioner of Public Health. Hi, Cheryl. Welcome back. Good to see you. Oh, you got to unmute, Cheryl. You got to unmute. Cheryl, I'm wondering if you can explain the relationship between the federal government and community health centers. Community health centers get funding, right, from the federal government, but how much? What is that relationship?
So there are two type of community health centers, one that's called the federally qualified health center, and those are the ones that obviously are regulated by the federal government, HRSA, as we call it, Health Resources and Services Administration, give the qualification to community health centers that meet the standards that they have in place to provide primary care services, and we get a certain amount of funding based on the number of patients that we serve every year. And so they provide some really core foundation funding, and they also ensure that we provide comprehensive care to the people that we serve.
And you said there's two types?
Oh, yes. Yeah, sorry. The other one, we call them lookalikes. They do the same thing, but a lot of them are affiliated with hospitals or standalones, and they haven't gone through the same kind of qualification status and don't get that kind of funding. They may get other kinds of federal grants, but not. There's a whole division within HRSA that is about promoting community health centers.
Senator Ted Kennedy played a crucial role in the creation of community health centers. There's a little bit of irony here that his nephew is now helm of Health and Human Services.
It sure is. And we have one of the first health centers in the country here in Boston and one in Louisiana. Doctors Geiger and Gibson were the founders of those two health centers. And when the senator saw what they were able to do and provide services for those who are uninsured, he really spent his career supporting these. And there are now, I want to say, at least 1,500 health centers across the country, and many of them have multiple sites. So there's thousands of them. Here in Massachusetts, we have 37 federally qualified health centers, and we serve about 1 million Massachusetts residents.
Talk a little bit about why we need to keep the measles in check when people say, well, it isn't fatal. It can be fatal, right? And the dangers to pregnant women, their unborn babies. Talk a little bit about why this is so important.
Well, I always say for people in an age range that didn't see what measles did and the morbidity and mortality, particularly associated with pregnant women, babies are born very badly deformed, very disabled. And that's very disheartening when you have a preventable solution. So to think that we're going to let this grow across our country after we've had this so controlled for so long is just kind of a little shocking.
Yeah. Are you hearing concerns from patients about guidelines that are coming from the CDC?
Say our patients have a tendency to have cultural and language barriers, so they may not understand it as completely as we do. And if they have questions, obviously we try to help them with that. I think in general, we're just concerned about how will our care deteriorate, and particularly in a state that has a lot of pride in the healthcare system that we've created. So I feel very fortunate that we have a state that's trying to come up with a solution that is going to be state driven with our own policies and will require our insurers to pay for it. Because as I said in the earlier segment, is that finances is a big barrier for people to get vaccinated. And the fact that we have all childhood vaccinations free in Massachusetts is pretty remarkable. And we definitely don't want to lose that and lose the ground that we have. But I would say the groundswell of anti-vaxxing will definitely put pressure on Massachusetts, because there will be parents that have that same point of view and now have a Secretary of Health who's kind of validating what they believe. And I think will put pressure on our local state policies.
Yeah. So how do we combat misinformation?
Well, that is a tough one. I have to say, during COVID, I stopped watching the news. Number one, and trying to get information from trusted professionals. We really, really thought strategically on what we were going to do to try to get people in and get vaccinated for COVID. And one idea I came up with: nurses, as you may be aware, are often considered the most trusted profession across the country. That's been for maybe 20 years now. So I got nurses that spoke the languages of our patients and had them on radios. I had them go to churches, tried to figure out where people go that they feel safe and that they have trusted advisors for other areas in their life, and that perhaps would help them gain trust with what we were suggesting was in their best interest for their health.
Cheryl Bartlett, CEO of New Bedford Community Health. Cheryl, thanks so much for sharing your insight with us. We appreciate it.
Welcome. Thank you, Mindy.
As we see cases of whooping cough and measles climb across the country, we've heard how Massachusetts is seeing more vaccine exemptions than ever for school kids. In three neighboring states, it's a different story. Maine, New York, and Connecticut all have new laws on the books doing away with religious exemptions. And now they're seeing more kids getting their vaccines. State House reporter Katie Lannon brings us that story.
North Saunders has a picture of his daughter from 2019, when she was three. She's standing on the steps of the Maine State House, raising her hands in the air.
It's wonderful to now think about, you know, her being involved that day when the law passed in Maine, and now, you know, sending her off to school every day.
She's celebrating a state law her dad helped pass there. It says that families can no longer cite religious beliefs to excuse their kids from the vaccines required in Maine public schools. That was 6 years ago. Now, Saunders and his group, American Families for Vaccines, are backing similar legislation in Massachusetts. The state has overall high childhood vaccination rates, but some pockets fall below the level needed for herd immunity. Supporters say the proposal could help close that gap and fend off future outbreaks. But that's only if policymakers decide to take it up. Medical groups are urging state lawmakers to act.
Welcome. Thank you for joining us for the Joint Committee on Public Health, today's hearing. I'm Senate.
In June, state lawmakers spent almost 8 hours hearing testimony on vaccine policy. One of the people testifying was Richard Moriarty from Plymouth. He retired after years as an infectious disease specialist for kids. Moriarty remembers when he himself was a kid and how his parents were scared to let him outside during polio outbreaks. Years later, he'd see parents in his practice question vaccines for their kids. He sent one unsure young mother a video of an infant with whooping cough.
And it's one of the most upsetting things that you can see. And she actually took my advice. She saw the film and then called me back and said, "I'm bringing my baby in for the shots."
Also at that statehouse hearing, a few dozen parents who want Massachusetts to keep its exemptions. They cited their beliefs.
To allow us to continue to live God's will according to our interpretation of the Bible.
Worries about influential drug makers.
You have become puppets of the pharmaceutical companies. You have all become indoctrinated.
And concerns of government overreach.
Do you represent us or do you rule over us? Because it's getting really hard to tell.
Saunders, the activist who helped get rid of religious exemptions in Maine, wants to convince Beacon Hill that the critics here may be loud, but they're actually a minority. In a poll, the Massachusetts chapter of American Families for Vaccines found that 3 out of 4 parents support getting rid of the religious exemption.
That's really the message that we're looking to deliver to lawmakers, is that this is a winner for you politically, that what your constituents want.
For a bill to pass, it has to catch the eye of the 2 Democrats who lead the House and Senate. At a recent press conference in the governor's office, reporters asked State Senate President Karen Spilka and House Speaker Ron Mariano about the bills. Here's Spilka.
I think it's important to hear from stakeholders and people and hear what they have to say. But I think it's important that vaccines are available and are given to people, including children.
And Mariano said there's a lot of misinformation and that leaders need to do better at educating fellow lawmakers. For Connecting the Commonwealth, I'm Katie Lannon on Beacon Hill.
We're discussing our series, Unraveling Immunity, and coming up, we'll hear from parents about religious exemptions. You're listening to The Point, and we're taking a closer look at the Connecting the Commonwealth series we're airing this week, Unraveling Immunity. The number of Massachusetts students claiming religious exemptions from vaccines hit an all-time high last year. Adam Riley talked to parents on this deeply personal, faith-based reasons why they're bypassing vaccines.
Bridget Kearns of Wareham is a mother of 2, and when her kids were younger, she agonized over vaccines. As an occupational therapist, she'd encountered multiple families who thought vaccines were harmful. But her struggle was also rooted in faith. Several vaccines are made using fetal cell lines created from abortions performed decades ago, though the American Academy of Pediatrics says vaccines do not contain actual fetal cells. At first, Kearns partially vaccinated her children. She felt the pressure to conform.
Early on, when you are trying to get your child health care and you're rejecting vaccines, it is very hard.
Then, one day, her dilemma disappeared.
I kept praying on it. I kept praying on it. And I really remember this moment when I really felt like I heard God in that moment. And what he said to me was that I have put my faith in man, and really where I needed to put my faith was in God.
From that point on, Kearns decided to seek religious vaccine exemptions for both her kids. Kearns grew up Catholic and now describes herself as a Christian. Her children, now 16 and 19, never got another shot.
I want to choose good and reject evil. And so at the core of abortion is evil.
It's not just Christian parents seeking exemptions. Historically, some Jewish, Hindu, and Sikh people have also expressed vaccine hesitancy due to their interpretation of faith, according to an NIH study. Omar Al-Farouk is an immigrant from Afghanistan. He told me via email he's puzzled by the rules. Schools respect that his children don't eat pork due to the Muslim faith, but those same schools demand vaccines that contain pork gelatin as an ingredient. Serious injuries from vaccines are extremely rare. Yet experiencing one of these events can be a powerful catalyst. Some parents we interviewed connect their medical concerns with their faith and become vocal critics of vaccine mandates. Take Mary Ellen Cottonsteady, a devout Catholic and abortion opponent. The Vatican has offered qualified support for the use of vaccines made with fetal cell lines. Still, in 2019, the Pontifical Academy for Life issued a statement urging Catholics to seek alternative vaccines if possible, and to put pressure on leaders to make new vaccines that aren't derived from fetal cell lines. Here's Cottonsteady reading a portion of that.
They should take recourse, if necessary, to the use of conscientious objection with regard to the use of vaccines produced by means of cell lines of aborted fetal origin.
But Cottonsteady has a much more personal reason for opposing vaccines. Her daughter Cecilia died at age 10, after nearly a decade of debilitating seizures that began after a DTaP vaccine.
She was pretty much wheelchair bound. By the time she died, she was just skin and bones.
The federal vaccine injury court sided with the family, finding that Cecilia's vaccination led to her neurological injury. Cecilia did receive a medical exemption before she passed away, but Cottonsteady argues that religious exemptions are a more effective way to prevent harm.
You don't know you need a medical exemption until your kid's already sick. You know, it's a game of, feels like a game of roulette, you know, like Russian roulette.
Another mother we interviewed was Candace Edwards. Her son, Oliver, has several health conditions she attributes to a vaccine injury. Now she feels her Christian duty is to protect her child from harm. She cites the psalm that reads, "Children are a heritage from the Lord." Edwards founded the group Health Action Massachusetts. Today, it's fighting on Beacon Hill to keep religious vaccine exemptions.
Faith is lived and it's not abstract. And for many families like myself, their child's suffering becomes part of their spiritual discernment. And saying that faith isn't, saying this isn't faith-based really misunderstands religion itself.
Their deeply held views point to a key dynamic, according to sociologist Christopher Scheidel of West Virginia University. He studies faith and vaccine hesitancy. Scheidel says vaccine advocates often rely on what's called the deficit model.
The idea that if people just knew more, they would agree, or they would be in support of vaccines. And essentially what a lot of this research shows is that it's not just about knowledge, or it's not just about educating people, that there are real kind of cultural, social-cultural barriers to some of these things.
For many conservative Christians, he says, the belief in an intervening God is a powerful counter-narrative to modern medicine.
Once you account for a person's sort of perception of God as not only able to intervene in the world, but willing to intervene in the world, that explains away some of the differences between, say, conservative Christians and other groups, or even more liberal Christians.
And he said some believe that suffering itself holds a kind of redemptive value. In the end, the debate over vaccine mandates is a conflict between core American principles: the freedom of parents to make decisions for their children, the liberty of religious practice, and the state's responsibility to protect the public. For Connecting the Commonwealth, I'm Adam Riley.
Dr. Paul Offit is the director of the Vaccine Education Center and attending physician in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Dr. Offit, good morning.
Morning.
Our number, if you'd like to ask a question or share a comment, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. I want to go back to a question I asked earlier, is that we hear some people say, well, I had measles as a kid and, you know, it isn't fatal, but in fact, children have died and it can be fatal, right?
Right. Well, I'm a child of the 50s. I had measles as a kid, and I was fortunate enough that I wasn't one of the 48,000 children who were hospitalized every year with severe pneumonia or dehydration or encephalitis, which is inflammation of the brain. I was fortunate that I was not one of those children who developed something called subacute sclerosing panencephalitis, which is a chronic measles infection of the brain, where you survive your measles, and then years later, you start to have a deterioration in your personality, deterioration in handwriting skills, and ultimately descend into a vegetative state from which you never escape, and it's a uniformly fatal infection. It occurs in roughly 1 in 100,000 children who are infected with measles. Why would you ever take that risk? When people say, you know, I had measles and survived it, that's because they were one of the survivors, but there are many children who didn't survive.
Yeah. And so when the measles vaccine, was it 1963? It was somewhere around there, right? 1963?
So the first measles vaccine was in 63. The last best measles vaccine, the one we use today, was in 1968.
And by 1981, all 50 states had school mandates. So what do you think led to our current situation of vaccine hesitancy? Is part of it this, you know, a lot of people just weren't around when we're a little bit on the older side, but there's some moms now who weren't there when, you know, to see this firsthand. So sort of a forgotten how bad it can be.
Exactly. I think it's not that we just eliminated measles from this country by the year 2000. I think we eliminated the memory of measles. I think people don't remember how sick or dead this virus can make you. I think vaccines in many ways are a victim of their own success. So we do have to step back and re-explain ourselves as to why vaccines are important. You didn't have to convince my parents to vaccinate me. You didn't have to convince me to vaccinate my children. But my children not only don't see these diseases today, they didn't grow up with these diseases. So it becomes a more difficult thing to sell.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the potential side effects of these vaccines. We know we heard in the story that Adam just reported, and it's certainly there are always side effects, but it's pretty rare, right?
Very rare. And I mean, so of course, like any medicine, or in this case, biological, that has a positive effect, there can be a negative effect. So very, very rarely the influenza vaccine can cause something called Guillain-Barré syndrome, meaning an ascending paralysis, maybe one in a million that happens to. The oral polio vaccine, which we used in this country from 1960 till 2000, was a very, very rare cause of polio itself, maybe one per 2.4 million doses, but it was real. You look at the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine that was authorized in February of 2021, was a rare cause of clotting, including clotting of the brain, including fatal clotting of the brain, which ultimately drove that vaccine off the market. So sure, vaccines can cause serious and occasionally fatal side effects, but they're extremely rare. And the benefits of vaccines invariably outweigh their risks because the diseases are much worse.
Explain the dangers and the risk we face when we don't have herd immunity. You know, as we mentioned, measles was declared eliminated from our country back in 2000. And are you concerned about other childhood diseases becoming more widespread or returning, like polio?
Right. Well, there was a case of polio in Rockland County, New York in 2022 of a 27-year-old man who was paralyzed by polio. Now, the strain he was paralyzed by or paralyzed with was a so-called revertant type 2 strain that was derived originally from the vaccine. Now, when that strain causes paralysis, it only causes paralysis in 1 in 2,000 people. So when he was paralyzed, you already knew he was the tip of a much bigger iceberg. And so when they looked in the wastewater of Rockland County or surrounding counties, they found that virus. And I think if you looked in the wastewater samples of Philadelphia, Chicago, or LA, you would also find that virus. Drop immunization rates low enough, and that was true in his particular area. In his area, vaccination rates dropped to 30%, and that was enough to allow polio to come back. Sure, I think, could polio come back? Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, we heard someone say they had shown a video of a child with whooping cough to a mom who then decided to have her child vaccinated. Is that something that we should be thinking? It's like just letting, you know, helping people understand the seriousness? Because, I mean, nobody likes to see their child sick to begin with. But measles and whooping cough, I mean, it's you can't even imagine how heartbreaking that is to watch your child go through that.
Right, and I think we should do everything we can to educate about the importance of the disease, the value of the vaccine. But I'll tell you something, it's a little disheartening. But when Maurice Hilleman is the inventor of the current measles vaccine, the one that we used starting in 1968, was called the Morton strain. He was the inventor. He's the inventor, actually, or developer of 9 of the 14 vaccines that we give to infants and young children. So as he was dying, he was diagnosed with disseminated pancreatic cancer. I interviewed him in the last 6 months of his life because I wanted to get his stories. But I asked him that question, and here it was 2004. We'd eliminated measles by 2000. Now it was starting to come back because Andrew Wakefield in England had claimed falsely that the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine caused autism. There was a deterioration in immunization rates, and measles was starting to come back. And I asked him this question, the inventor of the vaccine, can we explain how important this disease is? Can we explain how well this vaccine works? Or do we have to watch children once again suffer in order to get our attention about how important it is to vaccinate? And he spent a long time answering that question before he said anything. And then he looked at me sadly and he said, no, I think the disease is going to have to come back for people to understand how important it is. I hope he's wrong. I do hope he's wrong, but you know, he might be right.
So how do you fight misinformation, especially at a time when the CDC seems to be making recommendations that are not based on science?
Right. Well, frankly, we don't have a CDC anymore, or frankly, an Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices. They have been shredded by our current Secretary of Health and Human Services. It's hard to get good information out there because information is so siloed, you know, that people have their own silos that they get information from, and it's hard to cross into that other silo. There are a lot of people out there doing the best they can, and I applaud them for all that, including people like Dr. Bartlett. But We just have to keep trying, and in this compelling and passionate and compassionate way make our case. But we do ask a lot of parents in this country. We ask them in the first few years of life to get vaccines to prevent 14 different diseases. That can mean as many as 25 inoculations at that time. It can mean as many as 5 shots at one time to prevent diseases most people don't see, using biological fluids most people don't understand. And so it's we do have to step back and re-explain ourselves why it is so important. But you know, I I deal with a lot of parent advocacy groups like Families Fighting Flu, Meningitis Angels, National Meningitis Association. Those parents all tell the same story. I can't believe this happened to me. They chose not to get a vaccine. Their child died from pneumococcus, died from Haemophilus influenza type B, died from influenza. And they tell very compelling stories about how they had not made the right decision. You don't want to become a member of this group, these kinds of groups, because it's a game of Russian roulette we play. And there's not five empty chambers. Maybe there's 100,000 empty chambers, but why play the game?
And given the current distrust in advice coming out of the CDC, safe to say most parents do have trust in their children's pediatrician, right? Is that the best place that you, is that where you advise parents to go with their questions and seek guidance, is their children's pediatrician?
Yes. And I think that as we're watching this shredding of the CDC, and frankly, that we don't really have an ACIP that contains a good expert advisors that give us good information. The good news is groups like the American Academy of Pediatrics have come out and put out their own schedules. This is the best medical practice. And they work with insurance companies to make sure insurance companies will pay. And states like Massachusetts have done a great job at stepping up and saying, look, here's best medical practice. So I think we're doing the best we can right now to deal with the fact that we don't have a central agency like the CDC and the ACIP that we can look to anymore.
You know, we heard in one of the stories earlier, a parent who I think was with the PTO, and she had no idea that her school had vaccination rates that were well under the 95% needed for herd immunity. Is that something parents should be paying attention to? I mean, is that something we should be looking at? And then, you know, what's our role as far as, like, do we try to educate other parents? You know, what do you do with that information?
Now, maybe we could have a sign in front of the school that says, caution, the immunization rate in the school is 80%. Let me put this in perspective. There's something called the contagiousness index, meaning how many people will you infect during the day, assuming you're contagious and everybody you come in contact with is susceptible. For viruses like SARS-CoV-2, they're the cause of COVID, or influenza or respiratory syncytial virus, the contagiousness index is about 2 to 4. For measles, it's 15 to 18. It is the most contagious human infection, and it's always the first one to come roaring back when immunization rates fray, and that's exactly what you're seeing now. You're seeing the biggest measles epidemic in this country in 33 years. We've had 3 people die from measles in this country. That equals the total number of measles deaths over the last 25 years combined. We've had 2 healthy little girls, 6 and 8-year-old girls, die in West Texas, perfectly well-nourished and healthy. That's the first child death from measles in this country since 2003. This is a problem. And if we had a Secretary of Health and Human Services who was doing his job, he would stand up and using his national platform as Secretary of HHS, frankly, in his famous name, and he would say, vaccinate your children. These deaths are inexcusable. There's so much in medicine we can't do. There's so much we don't know. This we know, vaccinate your children. But he does exactly the opposite.
That's some sobering information there. My goodness, I had not heard that. So that, I want to ask just a quick question too. You know, when RFK Jr. came out and said Tylenol causes autism, what must have gone through your head when you heard that?
And the other things that were said during that same conference by President Trump, who said, separate the MMR vaccine into its 3 component parts. Delay the hepatitis B vaccine until you're 12 years old. Take mercury out of these. Take aluminum adjuvants out of vaccines. I mean, it was like one thing after the next. It was a fire hose of dangerously inexcusable information. I feel like this country has been taken over by a foreign country whose job it was to completely destroy public health. That's what that felt like.
All right. Trust in your pediatrician.
Yeah.
All right. Dr. Paul Offutt, director of the Vaccine Education Center and attending physician in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. You'll find a link to our Connecting the Commonwealth series, Unraveling Immunity, at our website, capeandislands.org. Dr. Offutt, thanks so much for taking time to be with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening. Mintz. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Burdery and William Coulter.